Welcome to Androids and Assets. I'm Marshall, your co-host.
And I'm Steven, your other co-host.
And we're really excited today to have SB Divya as our guest. Welcome, Divya.
Thank you very much.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do?
So I am an author of science fiction and fantasy. I am also co-editor of Escape Pod, a weekly science fiction podcast. And I'm an engineer who works in machine intelligence and signal processing by day. I'm very happy to be here chatting with you guys about science fiction and society and economics.
I had the chance when I was at Worldcon to have a conversation with Divya. And at the time, somehow when I got home, the recording didn't make it home with me. So we're really grateful that you're back for round two. Try it all over again and get the conversation out there.
Thank you very much.
One of the things I want to talk to you about today was your short story, A Contingency Plan for the Apocalypse. Did I say it? Did you get the title?
Yes.
Yeah. because I think that short story, I think, left a very strong impression on both of us and kind of our approach to like interpreting science fiction. Because it's it's a world where it's more driven by the revolutions in social technology than the revolutions in scientific technology.
Right.
Which is something we're very, very interested and excited about. Do you want to talk about that, or like that? What do you say are kind of the core themes? Because for me, there's like issues of federalism in the United States, issues of migration, issues of sexual politics and identity.
Absolutely. That story was inspired by sort of a congruence of events that was, obviously I wrote it in February of 2017, the first draft. And so Donald Trump had just gotten into office shortly before, and I was up at Mammoth Mountain on a snowboarding trip with some good friends, and I was having a conversation with one of them, and he was saying, maybe it's time for the Democrats to embrace strong decentralization of government and states' rights. And so that got me thinking immediately about the events of, 2012, 2013, when it came to women's reproductive health and a lot of the anti-abortion laws that were being passed at state level and, restrictions on access to all of that in certain locations within the country, and how challenging it was becoming, especially for people who did not have the means to just pick up and travel to go somewhere to get the care that they needed. So that was sort of my counter argument to him was, well, if we go for strong states' rights, we've effectively, given up on those people, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. People who are in states that maybe have more freedoms, more personal freedoms, or just generally more left-leaning politics, strongly separated from states that are the exact political opposite. And so out of that was born this story of, okay, on top of everything else, Joe Arpaio was in the news for Arizona and I live in California. And so all of this kind of came together with, what if, civil war in America in the future wasn't a matter of people lining up on a field shooting at each other like they did 150 years ago, but instead was this sort of very insidious divisions across state lines that where it almost looks like you're, crossing the border to another country. You're just crossing the border to another state.
What if Arizona was turned into Syria?
Yeah, almost. Not quite Syria, maybe more... oh my gosh, I'm blanking on the name of the nation in The Handmaid's Tale. But more like that, the Republic of Gilead, was it? Something like that?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, so it's like, what if, what if Arizona became like ultra-conservative Christian state with, very religiously based legal system at the state level, and it was allowed to have that. And right next door, you have California with all these crazy liberal hippies who want, kind of the opposite. And what would it mean for someone to try to work from within the system in a place like Arizona to maybe provide those underground services that, you know, inevitably people need wherever you are in the world, right? Mm-hmm. That has also been historically established. And then the main character has a lot of me in them, in that I too make a lot of contingency plans for worst case scenarios.
And bug out bag and home.
I almost do. I have a box of stuff literally behind me in this office in case of emergency fire evacuation, because we live three houses from a brush zone, right? And there's only one road to exit our little neighborhood here. So I have that. I also have fairly severe myopia, and I had surgery to have implanted contact lenses basically inside my eyeball. It's very cool.
That's cool.
A few years ago, but up until that point, without corrective vision, I was effectively legally blind. I literally could only see a few inches past my nose. And I always wondered, like, what if something happens in the middle of the night? You know, I don't have my contacts in. What if my glasses break? Or what if they don't break right away, but eventually I lose them too? Like, in the event of an apocalypse, how do I survive, right? So all of these things kind of intersected and formed the basis, ultimately, of the short story that kind of came pouring out of me in a few days.
Wild, wild. I mean, yeah, I'm very tickled by this concept of, Arizona just torn apart by war, by this, like, you know, not Salafi jihadists, but by evangelical crusaders.
Right.
Which I think is something, you know, is, I think, completely feasible, actually.
Yeah, I mean, frighteningly, it may not get as extreme as it is in that story, but, you know, we certainly have had situations in the past and probably will in the future where states enact laws that significantly contravene federal law. And then what? I mean, we're seeing it in the other direction with the whole sanctuary city, sanctuary state thing, right?
Yeah.
And it kind of begs the question, even if you happen to agree with the politics, is it okay for a state to give the finger to the federal government and say, no, we're going to break the law?
And
if we do that, does the whole system start to break down, right?
I mean, I feel as Canadians, there's just things we just... I hear about the United States, and I hear about the debates and, you know, like the way that the American discourse focuses on its constitution and its history and its kind of like semi-divine reverence for its law and its policy. And I, it's just part of it. I have a hard time wrapping my head around it. Like, I don't get how that, like, you know, just adapt and go with it and view the law as a living, dynamical thing, and if it's meeting people's needs, it's working, and if it's not, it's not working.
I think some of that reverence comes from sort of the mythos around the American Revolution and how very globally revolutionary it was for a group of people to stand up and say, we want this sort of representative democracy that the world hasn't necessarily seen before. And I think that's partly what makes the musical Hamilton. I don't know how familiar you guys are with that, but that's partly what makes the story in that really powerful to me too. And it's interesting because going all the way back, you know, to the framing of the U.S. Constitution and before, we've had this clash of, you know, states' rights versus centralized federal government, and which is better, right? There's always been two sides to that argument. And while the U.S. Constitution and the laws are treated as somewhat living, malleable, evolving things, this idea of uniting a group of states under one big umbrella of law that is not dictated by a monarch, that provides, I think, some really interesting sources of conflict that, you know, I don't know that that'll ever go away. Because again, every time your party is not in power, it's really tempting to be like, well, we're just going to go do our own thing then, you know, screw you people. sitting at the nation's capital, we don't like you anymore. So we're going to go off and do our own thing. And either side can do that. And I think the other part of it is because we're not parliamentary in any way, we have this two-party division. Like everything here is bicameral.
Yes. Yeah.
Right? Everything is binary. You're either this or you're that.
Canada's quite similar to that, actually.
Yes-ish.
Yeah. But anyway. That's the only thing that's mind-blowing, like the fact that you're kind of trapped. Because there is definitely differences between Democrats and Republicans. But there's also remarkable consensuses.
Consensus.
There's remarkable levels of consensus that they can have with each other, right?
Right.
Like, they can also completely agree. And then what do you do about that when they, you know, never mind when they disagree. What do you do when they agree? Because you're really stuck.
I think when they actually manage to agree is when we make progress. Or at least mostly agree, right?
Yeah.
I think when people lose respect for the system is when we have trouble. And that's the sort of trouble we see right now. Or that's the trouble we've seen every time we've had major social upheaval, like the civil rights movement, where people are like, look, the institutions are fundamentally failing us. Something has to change. At a systemic level of government. And it's going to be, I don't know, it's going to be very interesting, I think, the next century or so to see how this particular epoch in American history, which is already having ripples globally, right?
Yeah.
How those ripples are going to play out over time and how people are going to react to it everywhere. Because it's hitting everywhere. The backlash is happening, you know, throughout Europe now, throughout Asia. It's bad. The Middle East, I don't even know. They've never really managed to emerge out of conflict. And I feel bad. Similar to Central Africa, right? Where everybody in the world just wants them for their resources and they get exploited.
The ripples, I think, are even, not even, the ripples are definitely affecting us in Canada, where we have, there's a couple of conservative governments, one in Ontario and then one here in Alberta that's sort of, everyone seems to be thinking they're just going to win. But when it comes to sort of like state rights, so like provincial rights, we've built into our constitution a very civil method that a province can just say, yeah, we don't agree with that part of the federal law, so we're going to ignore it. They can just pass a law that says we're ignoring that one. And they, so it's like, so we have a conservative government in Ontario, you know, the biggest province, and
right.
And they have said they're quite willing to use this notwithstanding clause to just get out of following the constitution.
Right.
The Charter of Rights doesn't have to apply if they say it doesn't.
It's just a law. It's just another law, right?
And the government has said, like the provincial government has said, yeah, we'll use this whenever we want to because we believe that's what people want. And so we'll just do it.
I mean, this is the, I think when back at Worldcon, we were talking about Malka Older's series that starts with Infomocracy.
Yes.
Right. And that's where I felt like the future she envisions in that book and its sequels is so fascinating because it takes this exact concept of sort of decentralized democracy and distributes it evenly across the entire world.
Yeah.
Right. There's a supermajority, but there is no true centralized governance in that world.
Yeah.
And you are subject to whatever the laws are in your little tiny sentinel, right? You get to do what you want.
Yeah.
I have not finished reading the entire series, but I was curious when I finished it to see if she explores, because one thing I felt like she didn't explore that was part of what drove, you know, my story contingency plans was what happens to the people who can't pick up and leave their sentinel, right?
Yeah.
The people, the protagonists in her story are very mobile and they are citizens of the world and they move around. Even though they have a residence in some particular spot, they are constantly going places. But there are people the world around who don't have
guaranteed the right of migration.
But
yeah.
Yeah. But when you have this like radical, you know, like autonomy.
It's one thing to guarantee the right of migration though, but the economic ability for migration, right?
Mm-hmm.
Perfect mobility is a huge market failure that everyone in the world faces. There's just people who can't move out of a situation that they don't want to be in, but they can't go anywhere else.
Right.
And so you're right. Indian filmocracy, everyone does. Like, they have relatively disadvantaged people who just decide, ooh, I can't be here anymore. I better just pack up all of my stuff and go to a new place.
Right.
You can afford to do that in a week's time? Like, wow.
Yeah, and knowing Malka's background, I'm sure she's aware of the fact that there are people in circumstances who can't just pick up and move. And that's why I'm kind of interested to see, you know, when she finishes out the series, whether she ever explores those characters. She may not get to it. It might just not fit within the context of this particular story she's trying to tell with three books. But it is an interesting question, and it's kind of always been the fatal flaw in this sort of idealistic free market economics, right? It's like, well, is it really free when you don't have a completely free mobile labor force?
Yep.
We don't pretend to have that for the political system right now on the earth, but it is a really interesting idea. You know, what if we somehow centralize the ability that, yeah, we will provide you the means to relocate if you are not happy in this little pocket of governance that you're stuck in right now. Where would people go? Yeah. And so that's where all the immigration stuff came in as well. And obviously, it's a big part of my life because I immigrated to America when I was 5 with my parents. So really my parents did it. But I've grown up here feeling, I'm kind of one of those interstitial third culture type kids, right? Where it's like, I don't completely belong to the Indian culture. I don't completely belong to the American culture. I more strongly identify with the American culture because this is what I grew up with. But by the same token, my household had enough Indian culture that is also part of my life. And looking at what's happening the world over in terms of, you know, the push-pull of immigration, right? And people who are traditionally economically conservative, who are supposedly believing in the free market and are highly libertarian on the economic front, suddenly turn extremely protective and nationalist on the social front. It's like, you know, that doesn't quite fit with each other. Like, you can't have the one without the other and have the system work. It's going to collapse. So,
yeah. Well, this week I had the extreme displeasure of learning what identitarianism is.
Ooh, I haven't heard of that.
It's just white supremacist nonsense, but it's basically that, like, we were here, it's us, it's our identity, we need to our identity, our land, where we need to protect it. Ugh, you know, gross. But I think this thing is like, there can be these, like, and this thing we're talking about Ontario, like, sometimes what do you do when you have that sentinel that is like, this is our sentinel, we do with it what we want, everyone else can take a hike. What do you do when you have that sentinel? How does that system respond to that? Because I think one of the things we're learning is Ontario in Canada was considered the liberal. It was our California. It was our liberal coastal to a lake polity. And they elected the most reactionary, most extremely conservative government, predominantly in Toronto, our big cosmopolitan city.
Right.
Well, sorry, not the suburbs
of Toronto.
Okay. But anyway, yeah, would California in this scenario California has within it also the potentiality to become extremely reactionary.
It does, and it has been in the past. And I speak as someone living in a Republican district. There's a lot of wealth around me, and wealth seems to engender a lot of those kinds of feelings in people. It's happening. I mean, obviously, it's happened to the U.S. at a national level, right? And it's happened, I think, just recently in Sweden, elected someone populist. So it's, to me, looking at the long arc of history, I still feel like this is a local minima, so to speak.
Yes. Yeah.
Where, you know, there's always the two steps forward, one step back thing, right? Like, okay, the world is stepping back right now in a lot of places because we took those two steps forward, and there's a whole lot of people who got scared. and said, I don't like this. I don't like the way things are going. This is too much change, too fast. I need to take a step back. So we're seeing that step back. Obviously, very localized to this week and my country. We're seeing that with our Supreme Court nominee and all the conversations surrounding sexual assault and women's rights. And
just for clarity and posterity, you're talking about Brett Kavanaugh, right?
Yes, I'm talking about Brett Kavanaugh and Dr. Christine Ford and everything that's happening with the hearings. And, you know, yesterday, the Senate Judiciary Committee voted to move ahead with his nomination, but there will be an FBI investigation for a week, whatever. I feel like, hey, we've seen this before. Not just me. Everybody's looking back at Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill and saying, we've seen this before. Is it going to be any different now, you know, almost 30 years later, right?
Yep.
And I don't know. I don't tend to take bets. But if I had to lay odds, I'm going to lay odds that he's going to get confirmed just because politically I think there's so much push for it to happen, even though socially there's so much push against it. But I kind of wanted, you know, I've been saying to friends, family, colleagues that, look, even if he does get confirmed, it's pretty obvious that the social environment has shifted since Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill. Everything has been conducted in a very different way. And the palpable anger of women in this country is making change. It's maybe making change slower than some of us would like. And Brett Kavanaugh will be on the Supreme Court for the next 40 years, and it's going to affect things for the next 40 years. But we have been through those 40 years in the past too, and then managed to still move forward. So I think that engine of progress, you know, it's never going to stop. It might get slowed down, might even go in reverse for a bit, but it never stops ultimately gaining the ground. So that's where I kind of hold on to my long-term optimism in a lot of especially in the science fiction I write, it's sort of, you know, more of this near future, like next couple centuries, right? I appreciate dystopias sort of exploring the worst case scenario, but I never find them credible because historically, you know, we've had sort of these local minima where things have gotten really bad, but we've always come out of it. And so it's worth talking about and remembering those periods, but it's also worth bearing in mind that, yeah, there's hope.
So if you were to take contingency plans for the apocalypse and see the next 20, 30 years of that story, where would you envision it going?
I would say that much like what happened, you know, 5-6 years ago, there would be political agitation both from within those highly conservative states and from outside to liberate basically the population in those places to say that, look, what's happening is fundamentally depriving people of human rights within our own country, and possibly constitutional rights. Challenges would get taken, you know, up to the Supreme Court. Maybe Brett Kavanaugh is sitting there going, no, women don't have the right to control their own bodies in their own states. They need to just up and move or take a train, you know. But I think, especially in America, it works for and against us, but this sort of veneration of rugged individualism, right? That people are going to ultimately fend for themselves regardless of what their government says. Sometimes it undermines the system, but sometimes that undermining is good. And there are places in the world, to take abortion as an example, where it's illegal and people have parked ships in international waters and ferried women offshore to give them the treatment that they need. And this is happening today it will certainly, especially as technology and medical technology and medicine and pharmacology evolve going forward, will continue to happen in the future. There will be subversion anytime you try to curtail someone's human rights, especially in a country that supposedly values them. Individuals are gonna push back.
Are you familiar with Omar Ellicott's American War?
No, I am not.
It's an excellent novel. I highly recommend it. It's set in the near future United States, and several southern states have seceded again. After the North passed laws forbidding the use of fossil fuels.
Okay.
And so the South is saying, well, this is the only way that we have to survive. And so they secede. And so it's more of like a Cold War than the sort of the historic Civil War.
Right.
But it reminded me of this sort of contingency plans, in that you have the states and there's the people in the South who are still... they have political leadership that is forcing them to sort of cling to old ways. And there's people who are really disadvantaged and trying to get out. And
right.
People in the North trying to help them, and the South sort of fighting against it. I mean, yeah, so the story itself is mostly about a young lady growing up in this situation and sort of how it affects her and becoming radicalized. So
right.
It's... but it's very sympathetic to people who have become radicalized, which I think was interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's always that's a fascinating topic to explore. That was something I was researching for the book I'm working on as well, because we see that too, right? I mean, it's like, why is this backlash? Why do we have sort of a rise in conservatism and religious extremism, you know, throughout the world, right? It's not even just in the Western countries. It's happening in other countries too. And what gets into these people's heads, and what shaped them to kind of take these extreme actions, right? Obviously, they believe in something very, very strongly.
Yeah.
So strongly that they're willing to give up their life. That has a lot of emotional weight and resonance. So, yeah, that sounds like a great book. I will definitely check it out.
On a completely different topic, do you have any other stories or books that you've read that have really affected the way that you've viewed the world? And you said, oh, wow, I hadn't thought of that in that way before. That's a really great idea.
I haven't come across too many idea-based stories. I'm trying to think of something that fits that particular bill. I was, in light more of recent events, and because we just ran the story, I was going to bring up Andrea Phillips' The Revolution Brought to You by Nike.
Oh, that was such a great story.
In Fireside, and Escape Pod just recently ran it. And that is, it's not, arguably not even science fictional, you know. It's very similar to contingency plans, where it's like, the technology, there's nothing revolutionary in the technology. It's just a revolution in, you know, social history, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But, oh my God, it digs into economics and advertising. And it's just, you know, marketing. It's brilliant. It's brilliant exploration of consumerist culture, marketing, and corporate culture, and how that's intersecting more and more with politics, right?
Yep.
Which is, I think, pretty new. I mean, yes, Citizens United kind of turned one corner, but I think we're turning a different corner now, where your brand is part of your identity, and not just in like, I wear Jordache jeans and I'm cool, but more of, I stand for this and I will only buy products from companies that also stand with me for these values, right? And for corporations to espouse any kind of social values is, I feel like, a relatively new phenomenon, and doesn't seem to be one that's going away anytime soon.
I thought,
and that really highlights it really well.
Yeah. The choice in that story to use Nike, I thought, was really prescient.
It was. And we, by complete synchronicity, happened to be running the first part of the story the week that the Colin Kaepernick ad came out.
Yeah.
So yeah, we're all just kind of sitting there jaw dropped, like, wow, how did this happen? Good job, Andy. You totally predicted this one.
Yeah.
I don't know that this story enlightened me so much as really made me happy, and that is Cat Pictures Please by Naomi Kritzer, which won the Hugo.
So
but
good.
The reason, and I was super happy about that, and the reason is, again, I am, I think, fundamentally optimistic about the human condition, right? And we see so many negative stories about the horrible things AI is going to do, whether it's, you know, killer robots or just destruction of jobs, whatever. And I had been wishing for more to kind of counterbalance that. And that story just perfectly encapsulates, like, look, here is something good that could come of even, you know, our fantasy of emergent self-aware AI. That may never happen. But the point of the story is more like AI can be, you know, it can be a tool for social good as much as it can for evil.
Yes.
And there's no reason it has to fall to one side. So, yeah, so that's another one of my recent favorites. And in a similar vein, I don't remember if it made it on the ballot, but Jamie Walls's story from last year, Utopia LOL, which is set kind of in the very far future, in sort of a post-human context. But again, explores this idea of a, you know, well-intentioned, benevolent AI and how it might intersect with humanity in the long term.
And that concept of like a kind of great benevolent AI, that for me actually strongly synergizes this links back this conversation to our previous one. Because I'm just thinking on the fly here, but like we're talking about like, you know, why there are these regressive entities, like why you have Salafi jihadists and, you know, and evangelicals and things like that. And I think to some extent, I'm kind of like, they're not mustache twirling villains. They don't just want to hurt people for no reason. They are in a sense fearing they're losing their way of existing in the world. Not that I'm saying that's right, but they feel that way. And I wonder if it's like, there's this like clash both driven by modes of social control, right? Like religion is kind of like, you kind of talk about like a benevolent AI. That's kind of a, how does that break from religion in a certain light?
Right.
Yeah. So like, you know, kind of like there's this, like, there's a question about like, where do we go for authority and truth? And how do we distribute power in our society? And those that have found power in the old modes are literally fighting for their lives versus those that are pursuing power and privilege in the new modes.
Yeah, and I think one of the really interesting things to kind of come out of that I would like to see explored more is this idea of the digital divide. I feel like there's books that have probably touched on this, and I probably just haven't come across them, or maybe I've come across the blurbs and haven't read them. But the idea of the haves and have-nots in terms of access to different levels of technology. The interesting thing to me in counterpoint to reality there is a lot of people do have access to smartphones, which is fascinating in some sense because they're kind of set at a price point that ought to be a luxury item, but it's become such a necessity that even in some of the poorest places in the world, somebody in the village has a cell phone, you know, just like somebody always had satellite TV. And there is this innate human thirst for knowledge and connection that I think drives people to pool their resources to have that. And having that access, I mean, that's where a situation like China is really interesting, right? Because if you can control the information that the population has access to, you effectively shape their reality today. And vice versa, you know, if you are sitting in Syria and tweeting about the fact that people are bombing your village, you know, there was, what, like a 9-year-old girl that was doing that?
Well,
couple years ago?
No, it was this year. But yeah.
And okay.
She's very interesting.
It's just like, okay, there's this visceral reality of people, you know, using these tools to make sure the truth is known or spread. So actually, at Worldcon, I was on this panel where we were asking the audience to invent science fictional devices, or rather asking them to request us to invent science fictional devices. And somebody, because Cory Doctorow was on the panel, decided to ask, you know, how I want a device that separates fact from fake information, like truth from, you know, how do you know the fake news from the real news?
A lithiometer. Right?
And yeah, we kind of got into a fairly interesting discussion about, well, how do we do that going forward when, you know, we're able to fake things better and better, right? You can't even trust your eyes watching a video anymore. How do you know what's authentic and what's not? And this is going to become a bigger and bigger problem as more and more people are deriving this information from these devices that seem like firsthand sources, right? This is not even 50 or 60 years ago where it's like so-and-so told so-and-so, and you know it's gone through the grapevine, and so you have an inherent degree of skepticism. No, you have it in your hands, and to your brain, it looks like hard evidence, right? Because these are the sensory modes you use to interact with the world around you, and now that gets fake. What happens when we're all wearing augmented reality goggles and somebody hacks the system, right?
Yeah.
So I think some of these things, these are going to be questions that are going to be really interesting to explore. And again, you know, this is another place where I think Infomocracy was touched on, which is, do you centralize then the dissemination of information and put people you hopefully trust or you have vetted to be in charge of that dissemination?
Yeah.
How do we move forward in this world? It's going to be really interesting, I think.
Yeah, because I know in the Chinese people that I know and have spoken to, like, they know about the Great Firewall. They understand it. And some people I've talked to view it as something that protects them,
right?
Not something that constrains them, but actually blocks out things from the outside that they feel that they're legitimately so scared of.
Yeah. That is another form of protectionism again.
Yeah.
Right? It's your way of life that you're protecting, so you're keeping out the people who are trying to tell you otherwise.
Well, I mean, I think this is probably as good a place as any to wrap it up. Did you have anything else you wanted to add?
No, we didn't touch on runtime, but I did want to cycle back to that real quick when we were talking about immigration.
Yeah.
I think we're seeing more stories having to do with the immigrant experience, both in science fiction and fantasy too. I've been heartened to see a lot of not medieval epic fantasy, but more, I don't even know if magical realism is quite the right word, but it's sort of like a renaissance of urban fantasy minus the vampires and werewolves, just people with magic in the real world, but how, you know, that can often be an allegory for being a misfit, or, you know, I hate to bring it up, but even something like Harry Potter, as popular as it is, it's the sort of idea of, okay, well, you have, you know, this greater society of muggles that is only somewhat aware of this culture within itself, right?
Yeah.
And I think that kind of speaks in a way to the immigrant experience too. Yeah, so that was about it. And then I wanted to just give a shout out to Dread Nation, which is more alt history than science fiction. But I'm about a third of the way into it and thoroughly enjoying it. And I think it's a very cheeky but realistic exploration of, hey, what if there were, you know, a different outcome of the Civil War and it had to do with zombies and viruses, but what might a society look like at that time? And I think she's done Justine Ireland has done a really credible job of creating that world in a very believable manner. I'm looking forward to finishing reading that.
That's awesome. Do you want to talk about your work on Escape Pod and any projects you have coming up? Anything you want to plug?
Sure. We are just about to open for a holiday special submission period running from October 1st to 15th. We are looking for any end of year holidays, even from calendars that are not Gregorian that rotate. So if the holiday might happen to fall near the end of the year, that is fine. Science fictional context, of course. And in November, we're going to be running Sarah Pinsker's novella, And Then There Were N-1, which I don't know if you guys read that, but that's a super fun parallel multiverse type story where there is a convention of Sarah Pinskers from all these different universes, and they come together in one universe, and then one of them gets murdered.
That sounds amazing, and I'm looking forward. I haven't read it, but now I'm going to listen to it.
So we're running that as a four-parter for our November novella month.
Awesome.
Yeah, and you know, as always, we're looking for science fiction that really gets into, you know, a lot of what we've talked about here. You know, we want technological and scientific ideas, but we want them explored in the context of how they affect people, because stories are ultimately about people.
Thanks very much for being on the show with us. We're Androids and Assets. This was SB Divya. You can find us on Twitter at AssetDroid. Divya, your handle is Divya's Tweets.
That is correct. You can also find me on my website at www.eff-words.com.
Great. That's
fantastic. Thank you so much for having me. It's been super fun.
Yeah, thank you for talking to us. And can I say, as I was reading Contingency Path of the Apocalypse, I had two small children of proximal ages for the children in that short story kind of hanging off of me. And it was very impactful. So thank you for your writings.
Thank you. I'm glad it made an impact. That's what I was hoping for.
Thank you.